The Second World War, Chapter 14. Mr. Eden at the Foreign Office. His resignation.
The Foreign Secretary has a special position in the British Cabinet. He is treated with marked respect in his high and responsible office. But he usually conducts his affairs under the continuous scrutiny, if not of the whole Cabinet, at least of its principal members. He is under an obligation to keep them informed. He circulates to his colleagues, as a matter of custom and routine, all his executive telegrams, the reports from our embassies abroad, the records of his interviews with foreign ambassadors or other notables. At least this has been the case during my experience of Cabinet life. This supervision is, of course, especially maintained by the Prime Minister, who personally, or through his Cabinet, is responsible for controlling, and has the power to control, the main course of foreign policy. From him, at least, there must be no secrets. No foreign secretary can do his work unless he is supported constantly by his chief. To make things go smoothly, there must not only be agreement between them on fundamentals, but a harmony of outlook, and even to some extent of temperament. This is all the more important if the Prime Minister himself devotes special attention to foreign affairs. Eden was the Foreign Secretary of Mr. Baldwin, who, apart from his main well-known desire for peace and a quiet life, took no active share in foreign policy. Mr. Chamberlain, on the other hand, sought to exercise a masterful control in many departments. He had strong views about foreign affairs, and from the beginning asserted his undoubted right to discuss them with foreign ambassadors. His assumption of the premiership, therefore, implied a delicate but perceptible change in the position of the Foreign Secretary. To this was added a profound, though at first latent, difference of spirit and opinion. The Prime Minister wished to get on good terms with the two European dictators and believed that conciliation and the avoidance of anything likely to offend them was the best method. Eden, on the other hand, had won his reputation at Geneva by rallying the nations of Europe against one dictator, and left to himself might well have carried sanctions to the verge of war, and perhaps beyond. He was a devoted adherent of the French Entente. He had just insisted upon staff conversation. He was anxious to have more intimate relations with Soviet Russia. He felt and feared the Hitler peril. He was alarmed by the weakness of our armaments and its reaction on foreign affairs. It might almost be said there was not much difference of view between him and me, except, of course, that he was in harness. It seemed, therefore, to me from the beginning that differences would be likely to arise between these two leading ministerial figures as the world situation became more acute. This inauspicious situation developed steadily during the year that Eden and Chamberlain worked together. Early in October 1937, I was invited to a dinner at the Foreign Office for the Yugoslav Premier, Monsieur Stojadinovich. Afterwards, when we were all standing about, and I was talking to Eden, Lord Halifax came up and said in a genial way that Goering had invited him to Germany on a sports visit, and the hope was held out that he would certainly be able to see Hitler. He said he had spoken about it to the Prime Minister, who thought it would be a very good thing, and therefore he had accepted. I had the impression that Eden was surprised and did not like it. Everything passed off pleasantly. Halifax therefore visited Germany in his capacity as a master foxhound. He was in fact bidden to Berchtesgaden and had an informal and none too ceremonious interview with the Führer. This did not go very well. One could hardly conceive two personalities less able to comprehend one another. This high church Yorkshire aristocrat and ardent peace lover, reared in all the smiling goodwill of former English life, who had taken his part in the war as a good officer, met, on the other side, the demon genius sprung from the abyss of poverty, inflamed by defeat, devoured by hatred and revenge, and convulsed by his design to make the German race masters of Europe, or maybe the world. Nothing came of all this but chatter and bewilderment. I may mention here that Ribbentrop twice tendered me an invitation to visit Herr Hitler. Long before, as colonial undersecretary and a major in the Oxfordshire Yeomanry, I had been the guest of the Kaiser at the German maneuvers in 1907 and in 1909. But now they're at a different tune. Mortal quarrels were afoot, and I had my station in them. I would gladly have met Hitler with the authority of Britain behind me, but as a private individual, I should have placed myself and my country at a disadvantage. If I had agreed with the dictator host, I should have misled him. If I had disagreed, he would have been offended, and I should have been accused of spoiling Anglo-German relations. Therefore, I declined, or rather let lapse, both invitations. All those Englishmen who visited the German Führer in these years were embarrassed or compromised. No one was more completely misled than Mr. Lloyd George, whose rapturous accounts of his conversations make odd reading today. There is no doubt that Hitler had a power of fascinating men, and the sense of force and authority is apt to assert itself unduly upon the tourist. Unless the terms are equal, it is better to keep away. During these November days, Eden became increasingly concerned about our slow rearmament. On the 11th, he had an interview with the Prime Minister and tried to convey his misgivings. Mr. Chamberlain, after a while, refused to listen to him. He advised him to go home and take an aspirin. When Halifax returned from Berlin, he reported that Hitler had told him the colonial question was the only outstanding issue between Britain and Germany. He believed the Germans were in no hurry. There was no immediate prospect of a peace deal. His conclusions were negative and his mood passive. In February 1938, the Foreign Secretary conceived himself to be almost isolated in the cabinet. The Prime Minister had strong support against him and his outlook. A whole band of important ministers thought the Foreign Office policy dangerous and even provocative. On the other hand, a number of the younger ministers were very ready to understand his point of view. Some of them later complained that he did not take them into his confidence. He did not ever contemplate anything like forming a group against his leader. The chiefs of staff could give him no help. Indeed, they enjoined caution and dwelt upon the dangers of the situation. But the actual breach came over a new and separate issue. On the evening of January 11, 1938, Mr. Sumner Wells, the American Undersecretary of State, called upon the British ambassador in Washington. He was the bearer of a secret and confidential message from President Roosevelt to Mr. Chamberlain. The president was deeply anxious at the deterioration of the international situation and proposed to take the initiative by inviting the representatives of certain governments to Washington to discuss the underlying causes of present differences. Before taking this step, however, he wished to consult the British government on their view of such a plan and stipulated that no other government should be informed either of the nature or the existence of such a proposal. He asked that not later than January 17, he should be given a reply to his message, and intimated that only if his suggestion met with the cordial approval and wholehearted support of His Majesty's government would he then approach the governments of France, Germany, and Italy. Here was a formidable and measureless step. In forwarding this most secret message to London, the British ambassador, Sir Ronald Lindsay, commented that in his view the President's plan was a genuine effort to relax international tension, and that if His Majesty's government withheld their support, the progress that had been made in Anglo-American cooperation during the previous 2 years would be destroyed. He urged in the most earnest manner acceptance of the proposal by the British government. The Foreign Office received the Washington telegram on January the 12th, and copies were sent to the Prime Minister in the country that evening. On the following morning, he came to London, and on his instructions, a reply was sent to the President's message. Mr. Eden was at this time on a brief holiday in the south of France. Mr. Chamberlain's reply was to the effect that he appreciated the confidence of President Roosevelt in consulting him in this fashion for his proposed plan to alleviate the existing tension in Europe, but he wished to explain the position of his own efforts to reach agreement with Germany and Italy, particularly in the case of the latter. His Majesty's government would be prepared for their part, he said, if possible with the authority of the League of Nations, to recognize de jure the Italian occupation of Abyssinia, if they found that the Italian government on their side were ready to give evidence of their desire to contribute to the restoration of confidence and friendly relations. The Prime Minister mentioned these facts, the message continued, so that the President might consider whether his proposal might not cut across the British efforts. Would it not, therefore, be wiser to postpone the launching of the American plan? This reply was received by the President with some disappointment. He intimated that he would reply by letter to Mr. Chamberlain on January 17th. On the evening of January the 15th, the Foreign Secretary returned to England. He'd been urged to come back, not by his chief, who would consent to act without him, but by his devoted officials at the Foreign Office. The vigilant Alexander Cadogan awaited him upon the pier at Dover. Mr. Eden, who had worked long and hard to improve Anglo-American relations, was deeply perturbed. He immediately sent a telegram to Sir Ronald Lindsay, attempting to minimize the effects of Mr. Chamberlain's chilling answer. The President's letter reached London on the morning of January 18th. In it, he agreed to postpone making his proposal, in view of the fact that the British government were contemplating direct negotiations. But he added that he was gravely concerned at the suggestion that His Majesty's government might accord recognition to the Italian position in Abyssinia. He thought that this would have a most harmful effect upon Japanese policy in the Far East and upon American public opinion. Mr. Cordell Hull, in delivering this letter to the British ambassador in Washington, expressed himself even more emphatically. He said that such a recognition would rouse a feeling of disgust, revive and multiply all fears of pulling the chestnuts out of the fire. It would be represented as a corrupt bargain completed in Europe at the expense of interests in the Far East in which America was intimately concerned. The President's letter was considered at a series of meetings of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Cabinet. Mr. Eden succeeded in procuring a considerable modification of the previous attitude. Most of the ministers thought he was satisfied. He did not make it clear to them that he was not. Following these discussions, two messages were sent to Washington on the evening of January the 21st. The substance of these replies was that the Prime Minister warmly welcomed the President's initiative, but was not anxious to bear any responsibility for its failure if American overtures were badly received. Mr. Chamberlain wished to point out that we should not accept in an unqualified manner the President's suggested procedure, which would clearly irritate both the dictators and Japan. Nor did His Majesty's government feel that the President had fully understood our position in regard to de jure recognition. And the second message was, in fact, an explanation of our attitude in this matter. We intended to accord such recognition only as part of a general settlement with Italy. Thus it was that President Roosevelt's proposal to use American influence for the purpose of bringing together the leading European powers to discuss the chances of a general settlement, this, of course, involving, however tentatively, the mighty power of the United States, was rebuffed by Mr. Chamberlain. This attitude defined in a decisive manner the difference of view between the British Prime Minister and his Foreign Secretary. Their disagreements were still confined to the circle of the Cabinet for a little time longer, but the split was fundamental. The comments of Mr. Chamberlain's biographer, Professor Feiling, upon this episode are not without interest. While Chamberlain, he said, feared the dictators would pay no heed, or else would use this lineup of the democracies as a pretext for a break, it was found on Eden's return that he would rather risk that calamity than the loss of American goodwill. There was the first breath of resignation, but a compromise was beaten out. Poor England, leading her free, careless life from day to day, amid endless good-tempered parliamentary babble, she followed wondering along the downward path which led to all she wanted to avoid. She was continually reassured by the leading articles of the most influential newspapers, with some honorable exceptions, and behaved as if all the world were as easy, uncalculating, and well-meaning as herself. It was plain that no resignation by the Foreign Secretary could be founded upon the rebuff administered by Mr. Chamberlain to the President's overture. Mr. Roosevelt was indeed running great risks in his own domestic politics by deliberately involving the United States in the darkening European scene. All the forces of isolationism would have been aroused if any part of these interchanges had transpired. On the other hand, no event could have been more likely to stave off or even prevent war than the arrival of the United States in the circle of European hates and fears. To Britain, it was a matter almost of life and death. No one can measure in retrospect its effect upon the course of events in Austria and later at Munich. We must regard its rejection, for such it was, as the loss of the last frail chance to save the world from tyranny, otherwise than by war. That Mr. Chamberlain, with his limited outlook and inexperience of the European scene, should have possessed the self-sufficiency to wave away the proffered hand stretched out across the Atlantic, leaves one, even at this date, breathless with amazement. The lack of all sense of proportion, and even of self-preservation, which this episode reveals in an upright, competent, well-meaning man, charged with the destinies of our country and all who depended upon it, is appalling. One cannot today even reconstruct the state of mind which would render such gestures possible. I have yet to unfold the story of the treatment of the Russian Office of Collaboration in the advent of Munich. If only the British people could have known and realized that having neglected our defenses and sought to diminish the defenses of France, we were now disengaging ourselves one after the other from the two mighty nations whose extreme efforts were needed to save our lives and their own, history might have taken a different turn. But all seemed so easy from day to day. Let the lessons of the past be a guide. It must have been with declining confidence in the future that Mr. Eden went to Paris on January the 25th to consult with the French. Everything now turned upon the success of the approach to Italy, of which we had made such a point in our replies to the President. The French ministers impressed upon Mr. Eden the necessity of the inclusion of Spain in any general settlement with the Italians. On this he needed little convincing. On February the 10th, the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary met Count Grandi, who declared that the Italians were ready, in principle, to open the conversations. On February the 15th, the news came of the submission of the Austrian Chancellor, Schuschnigg, to the German demand for the introduction into the Austrian cabinet of the chief Nazi agent, Seyss Inquart, as Minister of the Interior and head of the Austrian police. This grave event did not avert the personal crisis between Mr. Chamberlain and Mr. Eden. On February the 18th, they saw Count Grandi again. This was the last business they conducted together. The ambassador refused either to discuss the Italian position towards Austria or to consider the British plan for the withdrawal of volunteers, or so-called volunteers, in this case five divisions of the regular Italian army, from Spain. Grandi asked, however, for general conversations to be opened in Rome. The Prime Minister wished for these, and the Foreign Secretary was strongly opposed to such a step. There were prolonged parleyings and cabinet meetings. Of these, the only authoritative account yet disclosed is in Mr. Chamberlain's biography. Mr. Feiling says that the Prime Minister let the cabinet see that the alternative to Eden's resignation might be his own. He quotes from some diary or private letter to which he was given access the following statement by the Prime Minister. I thought it necessary to say clearly that I could not accept any decision in the opposite sense. The cabinet, says Mr. Feiling, were unanimous, though with a few reserves. We have no knowledge of how and when these statements were made during the protracted discussions. But at the end, Mr. Eden briefly tendered his resignation on the issue of the Italian conversations taking place at this stage and in these circumstances. At this, his colleagues were astonished. They were much shaken. They had not realized that the differences between the Foreign Secretary and the Prime Minister had reached breaking point. Evidently, if Mr. Eden's resignation was involved, a new question raising larger and more general issues was raised. However, they had all committed themselves on the merits of the matter in dispute. The rest of the long day was spent in efforts to induce the Foreign Secretary to change his mind. Mr. Chamberlain was impressed by the distress of the cabinet. Seeing how my colleagues had been taken aback, I proposed an adjournment until next day. But Eden saw no use in continuing a search for formulas, and by midnight, on the 20th, his resignation became final. Greatly to his credit, as I see it, noted the Prime Minister, Lord Halifax was at once appointed Foreign Secretary in his place. It had, of course, become known that there were serious differences in the cabinet, though the cause was obscure. I had heard something of this, but carefully abstained from any communication with Mr. Eden. I hoped that he would not on any account resign without building up his case beforehand and giving his many friends in Parliament a chance to draw out the issue. But the government at this time was so powerful and aloof that the struggle was fought out inside the ministerial conclave and mainly between the two men. Late in the night of February 20, a telephone message reached me as I sat in my old room at Chapel, as I often sit now, that Eden had resigned. I must confess that my heart sank, and for a while the dark waters of despair overwhelmed me. In a long life I've had many ups and downs. During all the war, soon to come, and in its darkest times, I never had any trouble in sleeping. In the crisis of 1940, when so much responsibility lay upon me, and also at many very anxious, awkward moments in the following 5 years, I could always flop into bed and go to sleep after the day's work was done, subject, of course, to any emergency call. I slept sound and awoke refreshed, and had no feelings except appetite to grapple with whatever the morning's boxes might bring. But now, on this night, February 20, 1938, and on this occasion only, sleep deserted me. From midnight till dawn, I lay in my bed, consumed by emotions of sorrow and fear. There seemed one strong young figure standing up against long, dismal, drawling tides of drift and surrender, of wrong measurements and feeble impulses. My conduct of affairs would have been different from his in various ways, but he seemed to me at this moment to embody the life hope of the British nation, the grand old British race that had done so much for him and yet had some more to give. Nigh with John, I watched the daylight slowly creep in through the windows and saw before me in mental gaze the vision of death.